you're pushing the next Google, the next Microsoft, somewhere else. And founders have been moving, particularly in the Web3 space, have been moving away from the US and into other places, specifically because there's so much regulatory uncertainty. It's not that the founders themselves are necessarily panicked about the uncertainty. It's that the investment community finds it difficult. A lot of the investment funds are flowing into things that seem much safer. So generative AI, large language models, and away from things that use the word token and tokenization and crypto. The intersection of those two is vastly important, and the projects that span those are going to be the next killer apps. Smart regulation is paramount. It's the bedrock for capital formation.
Welcome to season two of From the Blockchain, where we speak to today's most innovative entrepreneurs and thought leaders to unpack the true potential of smart contract technology, Web3, and the digital frontier. I'm your host, Ashley Smith from Fame Lady Squad, and I'm thrilled to have you join today's top-tier community of forward-thinking trailblazers. We're here to foster a culture of idea sharing, creativity, and innovation that transcends industries, revolutionizes business, and drives meaningful conversation. If you're ready to forge a path to becoming a thought leader in your industry or organization, think of this podcast as your compass. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and be part of our amazing community. Oh, and please note that this podcast is for informational entertainment purposes only and should not be considered financial or investment advice. Alrighty, everybody, enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to From the Blockchain. I am very excited about today's episode. I have a very special guest. I'm hoping to dive into some topics related to blockchain technology that we haven't quite touched on, at least not in any deep way yet. We're going to be talking about policy, governance, the framework for how countries should be looking at some of this technology, and also the intersection with artificial intelligence. So my guest today is Benjamin Yablon. I'm going to give a little bit of a background so you all know the incredible work that he's been doing. Benjamin is the founder of Orbu.ai, a platform leveraging collective intelligence, Web3, and AI for better financial predictions. He co-founded Salt Blockchain, the world's first crypto lending platform, in 2016. In 2017, he moved from the US with his family to Africa and later to London to create Salt's global architecture. He serves as special advisor to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, also known as the OECD, which is probably the acronym we'll be using when we refer to that in today's discussion. So that's the OECD, where he helps craft global regulatory policy specific to the sensible deployment of financial and other technologies, including blockchain, distributed ledger, machine learning, and AI. He has participated as an expert speaker at the OECD's headquarters in Paris dozens of times and has provided expert insights at global NGO events in dozens of countries. In 2019, Benjamin was appointed by the OECD to serve on the Blockchain Expert Policy Advisory Board. The priority of this board is the development of a policy framework for governments and industry on viable innovation and adoption of distributed ledger technologies similar to the principles of artificial intelligence, which were supported by all G20 members in June 2019. Benjamin spent his early career as a practicing attorney focused on emerging financial technology platforms and regulatory compliance. No big deal. Welcome, Benjamin, to From the Blockchain. Thank you so much for being here. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me, Ashley. It's a pleasure.
Hey, I really appreciate it. I mean, you are working on a lot of things. You're publishing a lot of different articles, really a thought leader in this space, and also looking at artificial intelligence and some of the solutions that these two technologies can bring to complex challenges. I would love to know, before we dive in, maybe a little bit about your why. Why are you working on these things? Why does it matter to you?
Oh, great question. So my fascination with AI goes back to the early 2000s, when I read a book by Ray Kurzweil called The Singularity is Near. So a lot of people in AI have read this book, and it foretells the coming nexus of humanity with machines, etc. It's a fascinating read. I recommend anybody check it out. And I was never really able to look away from tech after that. I was a practicing attorney, but obsessed with all things AI until I ran into blockchain in its earliest days. So around 2011 and 2012, I was a practicing attorney doing a lot of work in insolvency. So bankruptcy cases for businesses and individuals. Mm-hmm. And as part of that process, people were being stripped of their assets. So bank accounts are frozen, wages are garnished, properties are liened, on and on and on. And along comes this concept of sovereign digital property. So the idea of these digital assets that were self-possessory was incredibly compelling. And so the idea of Bitcoin, obviously, the first and some would argue the only valid use case of blockchain to date, is one element of that. But everything we touch is digital, and the implications of having sovereignty over everything we touch that's digital really resonated, and I was never able to look away. So that the why is that it became an obsession, and aside from the birth of my children, the happiest day of my marriage was when I found a Bitcoin meetup group in Denver, so I could stop talking exclusively to my wife about how neat this tech was and could have some other like-minded people to share the possibilities with. And that ultimately led to the founding of Salt, which was the first company to lend against Bitcoin using it as collateral. Salt is still around, is doing some really interesting things. Others in that framework have met ignominious ends, and it's been a wild ride in crypto margin lending. But full disclosure, I'm a lawyer, so I'm perfectly happy to talk nonstop, Ashley. So break it up.
Well, I do feel there's value for our audience to maybe have some deeper context of some of that previous, or not previous, but earlier work that kind of set the stage for some of the things that you're doing today. Can you tell us just simple terms what it means to be borrowing against digital assets?
Yeah, so it's the closest similar process would be using a stock portfolio as security for a loan denominated in fiat. So instead of putting your Apple stock up and getting a loan in dollars, you would use your Bitcoin, ETH, or some blend of digital assets as collateral and get a loan against those assets. And this proved to be a very popular idea because people that believe in Bitcoin believe that it's going to continue to rise in value. And so their worst nightmare is having to be a forced seller. What they want to do is HODL. And life can make that impossible. Salt was a solution, and crypto lending is a solution for the long-term holders to be able to preserve their asset, pay a smaller interest rate than the inflation and the rise of value that they would see in the underlying asset. So very simple model. But anything that seems simple often isn't. And as we saw with other crypto lenders, a lot of other features were injected into that model that resulted in sort of catastrophic failures. And we're still dealing with the fallout from several of those.
So first, just for our audience sake, HODL means hold on for dear life. So that's just a popular acronym that's used. But I think more importantly, I'm assuming this really introduced you, especially as a lawyer and having a legal background, but to that, the significance of the regulatory framework and why it matters and the dangers of maybe for the public putting their money into platforms or using platforms where there may be not as many safeguards. Is that true?
Definitely. The early experience with Salt led to many conversations with regulators, some of them good and some of them very bad. And that was a big piece of why, as an attorney, I felt really strongly that I had some important things to try to share directly with the regulatory community to help them make sense out of what real dangers were and what they were over-prioritizing that wasn't a problem. So, you know, when you're dealing with a regulator that has never held crypto and doesn't like it, doesn't want anything to do with it, but is in charge of it, you have this mismatch of incentives. So helping regulators understand which elements of the technology and crypto assets were genuinely non-threatening and innovative and important and could actually empower the whole swaths of the world became very important to me. And then I was fortunate to have been so early in this to then get pulled into some of these other high-level conversations like the OECD's blockchain initiative and others.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the OECD? First, for anyone who's listening that's never heard of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, who are they and what is their mandate?
This is my favorite thing people ask me. So I'm an American, obviously, and I hadn't heard of the OECD until I was traveling abroad and you know, a student of history, but you know, I know a lot about World War II and the rest. And an understanding of why the OECD exists ties directly to World War II and the destruction of Europe. So after World War II, Europe is effectively in shambles, and the US deploys the Marshall Plan. And the OECD was created to administer the Marshall Plan, and that's the rebuilding of Europe's infrastructure. So the Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation, headquartered in Paris, it was responsible for the connection, the connective tissue of all things economic in the rebuilding of Europe with very close ties to the US. So the OECD is actually quite big. It has 13 different directorates that span everything from science and technology to insurance markets, financial markets, etc. It includes something called the FATF, which is independent but sits within the OECD and is a very important policymaking organization that basically sets counter-terror and money laundering policy. So very important initiatives come out of FATF. And the OECD generally is an economic think tank. The best way to think of it is as a macroeconomic think tank.
Can you give us an overview of the type of work that the OECD is doing now then with blockchain technology at the forefront?
Yeah, definitely. So any emerging technology or market conversation, they're very active in conversations around Africa, et cetera. The OECD serves a very important convening role. So it's not the United Nations. It's not the G7, which is very, very small. It includes members of both, but it's primarily a group of Western countries that are involved at the OECD level. And what they have is massive convening abilities to bring multi-stakeholder parties together from government, private sector, et cetera, and moderate these discussions and come out of them with policy recommendations. And those can either be adopted or not by respective governments, but they're often the early signs of where a particular piece of technology or regulatory initiative will head. So it's early in the conversation. It's similar in some ways to what goes on at the World Economic Forum at Davos, but with a much broader mandate. So it's similar in some ways to some of the policy initiatives that we see from groups like WEF, but actually much, much broader in terms of the scope and scale of what the OECD's mandate looks like.
I did have a look at some of the articles that you and Cyrus Hodas have put out together. I'll make sure to link them in the show notes for people to reference. There's a lot of interesting takeaways from these articles. And, you know, you talk a lot about, of course, decentralized ledger, blockchain technology, as well as artificial intelligence. One of the, I think, things that is easy for people to understand and digest are quotes like, it is important to note that the speed at which both these technologies are being developed and deployed far outpace what legislators and regulators can tackle. Can you add to that a little bit? Like, what are you seeing? How are you finding just the sort of reaction response from regulators and legislators? And I think it's very much in the public discourse right now related to artificial intelligence. I think even in the public realm, people have a better understanding, at least in their own minds, they have some understanding of what the tech might be able to do and have fears around that. When it comes to blockchain technology, I think many folks don't even really understand that the tech exists. So sure. Anything you can speak to related to that, and how, how do we deal with this? How do we deal with regulators and governments doing things that make sense in a time when everything's moving so fast?
You know, I had an interview with CZ from yes. Binance a few months back, where we talked about this very thing. And so to quote him, small jurisdictions are able to be really nimble and make decisions quickly with respect to innovation trends. Large jurisdictions, China, the US, struggle with that. And particularly in the US, we're dealing with a highly politicized process now. So whether the ideas are good or not is somewhat secondary to whether or not there's some political motivation around backing it or not backing an initiative. And what that's resulted in, particularly in the US, is a completely fragmented regulatory environment where innovation has been slowed and has been pushed into other jurisdictions. So, you know, the EU has done some very interesting things. The UK has done some incredibly interesting things to begin to bring projects that can't find a home in the US and are looking for good jurisdictions in terms of a fair-minded, robust judiciary with a well-understood case law, et cetera. So rule, where there's really rule of law, where you're going to be really happy that your IP sits in that jurisdiction in the case you need to defend it. Mm-hmm. Then there's some other smaller jurisdictions, Mauritius in particular, Bermuda in particular, that have done brilliant things from a regulatory perspective. They've been at the OECD, they've been at the WEF, but they're not being led by the larger jurisdictions. They're listening to what the problems are. They're looking at the actual threats, the actual systemic risks, and then crafting legislation and getting it pushed through. So Bermuda in particular is really on the forefront of making incredibly important moves in banking. So as we saw in the US, there were multiple failures of crypto-specific banks, SVB, Silvergate, on and on. Bermuda has watched those things and is still charging forward and making sense out of a sensible regulatory regime to allow digitally native banks to exist and to service customers. And they're going to be big winners. I strongly believe that there's still an enormous story to be told around digital assets as a native form of value. So just there's a lot left in the tank for the story of crypto. We're coming up on the halving of Bitcoin next year. There's a lot of speculation about what the price is going to look like. I love those discussions, although I'm not one to take positions one way or the other. I really am fascinated by and study the psychology of what these market iterations mean. That's a big piece of the tool I'm building, which is this hybrid prediction market with an AI backend to understand the swarm intelligence of the group to make sense out of what's coming next. Mm-hmm. So I spend a lot of time obsessing about the future, but not a lot of time making bets on it. It's sort of the selling shovels to miners conversation.
That being said, I do wonder just about the general public, let's say business leaders, government leaders, industry leaders, folks who have a vested interest in the success of whatever it is that they're working on. First of all, should they care about the technology? And should they care about how fast or slow their government comes together to create parameters for them related to this? Like, what is the risk, generally speaking, if the community, the public community, aren't given parameters? Like, mm-hmm. is there fear of being left behind?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, you think about the largest tech companies that are US-based. Those are enormous economic drivers. But the innovation that's happening now is around the Web3 technology set. I don't even know if people say Web3 now.
We do sometimes.
Blockchain and DLT on the one hand, AI and machine learning on the other, the intersection of those are the next unbelievably important companies. We see that with OpenAI. We see large incumbents producing other really compelling AI solutions. You know, Google's Bard, very compelling stuff. And Cyrus, when he joins us next, we'll get into granular detail on AIGC chain, which I think is very well poised to be in the discussion for how these systems should be built and why. Mm-hmm. But the fear is just you're pushing the next Google, the next Microsoft, the next X somewhere else. And that's mm-hmm. that's a real phenomenon. And founders have been moving, particularly in the Web3 space, have been moving away from the US and into other places for the last few years, specifically because there's so much regulatory uncertainty. And mm-hmm. and it's not that the founders themselves are necessarily panicked about the uncertainty. It's that the investment community finds it difficult, I think, to pick safe places to make those bets. So they're, you know, they a lot of the investment funds are flowing into things that seem much safer. So generative AI, large language models, etc., and away mm-hmm. from things that use the word token and tokenization and crypto at the moment. Mm-hmm. And those, the intersection of those two is vastly important. And the projects that span those are going to be the next killer apps. And as a result of sort of the regulatory terror that we see in places like the US, those projects are finding homes in other places like Europe. So mm-hmm. What I think it was A16 just set up in London. So, you know, Andreessen Horowitz just opened an office here. Rishi Sunak was ecstatic. You know, there's a lot of movement actually going on in terms of the investment community looking for a home where they're going to have a safe, stable regulatory environment and innovators coming in. So that's a long, long way of saying smart regulation is paramount. It's the bedrock for capital formation.
So just a note to our audience, we do hope to speak with Cyrus Hodes, Benjamin's partner, and dive a little bit deeper into some AI soon. So watch for that upcoming episode. It's worth noting, so we're recording on September 26th. Yesterday, Amazon made a huge investment in AI, committing up to $4 billion in Anthropic. So that's, I mean, there's these things are happening. Yeah. I do feel like it feels very obvious right now that people are wanting to invest in AI, but there's still a lot of fear around it. But with the blockchain technology stuff, I think there's just been such a narrative around cryptocurrency, market speculation, and people kind of think it's all dead. But I want to speak to, like, the response you just gave to me makes a lot of sense. But I also feel like it's touching on, you know, new enterprise, new technology, startup culture, business opportunities. But I know that a lot of this technology can have such a huge impact on resources and services and things that day-to-day people that may not care necessarily about the technology, but it might benefit them. You and Cyrus put out a really great piece on healthcare as an example, and discussed the sort of use case for blockchain technology and AI working kind of together. You mentioned that these two technologies are frequently underestimated as a harmonious technological duo, and wrote about this in the context of healthcare. Maybe we can touch a little bit on where you see the opportunities in that space. I will mention that we've talked about healthcare on the show, but in very superficially. We've had a few folks say that they feel that's an area for a lot of innovation, but we haven't really discussed what that innovation could look like. So I'd love for you to give our audience some insights as to what you see as the possibilities and what's actually happening out there.
So there's a lot there. So the impact of AI on healthcare is one track, and the impact of blockchain on the underlying data sets that make up our healthcare system is another, but they do interrelate. So I'll start with blockchain. DLT.
May we just tell the audience what DLT is?
Sure. So DLT is distributed ledger technology. That's an umbrella term, which includes blockchain. And there are different ways to arrive at consensus. Blockchain is one of them, but distributed ledger technologies include things like hash graphs, which is another way of reaching consensus that is in some ways much, much faster than a blockchain and actually requires a lot less energy. So I know this is another area you want to get into in terms of the energy usage around crypto, et cetera. So under the umbrella of DLT, healthcare specifically can be an enormous beneficiary. So if you think about how cumbersome it can be to move health data from one point to another, you already know that something's wrong with that system. Distributed ledgers are a perfect way to both preserve the anonymity and or confidentiality around people's medical data while opening up that medical data to a much larger group of people that are interested in it. So it opens up several possibilities, the first being just the portability of your data, being able to move medical data from A to B. The second would be the ability to permission who sees that data. So DLT allows for things like strong permissioning. Next, you get into issues of who that data is valuable to. And on the last report I read said that on the black market, medical records are the most valuable thing people buy. So there's a reason that we have these siloed systems with heavy-duty security around them. The hackers and nefarious folks have a significant interest in getting access to medical data specifically.
Can I ask just as to why that might be?
There are a lot of reasons for it. But in terms of being able to steal an identity, that's a significant component. And then there are marketplaces for that kind of health data. So understanding, and not all of these uses are nefarious, let me be clear. So if you're a research hospital and you need to study a very specific disease, you are highly limited in terms of the sample sets that you can access at the moment. If we were on a distributed system where those institutions were able to both access and pay for that data, that would be an enormous monetization of patient data that would be beneficial to the patients. As it stands, and instead what we have is a situation where medical data is highly siloed and dependent upon the provider, and the research hospitals with relationships with that provider are able to do their clinical trials. They do not compensate the patient for the use of that data. They compensate the data owner, in this case, the provider. So if we were to flip that around, if you owned your health data in the same way that you own your NFT, your Bored Becky, imagine the power of that. So if there were some genetic condition that a research hospital were studying, they could see that you had a marker for it. They could hypothetically transact with you for that data set, all while preserving the security and anonymity of the underlying patient. So the implications of what DLT does and blockchain are enormous outside of the movement of crypto assets. And the public gets myopically focused on crypto as the use case. It's a use case. There are a number of ways that this tech will benefit humanity. And we get into a strange territory where it's like in 1999, the HTTP protocol, I think it was 99, was revolutionary. And everybody was talking about HTTP. But you fast forward, 5 to 8 years later, nobody talks about HTTP. I think blockchain will be the same, honestly, that it's going to be integrated in as a security layer into everything we touch. And we won't talk about it as blockchain or DLT per se. It will be part of the security layer of our digital interactions.
I really appreciate that overview. I think that a lot of the times in this type of conversation, we talk about owning your data, and I'm not sure it's always so clear as to what that means. And I do think that this gives a very specific and digestible example of how you really can own your data and choose how that data is used. I do wonder, is this right now just a concept? Like, are there organizations actually working actively on implementing this type of technology in this way? Like, do we see hospitals or like who would be creating that sort of framework? It would probably maybe not be coming from within the health space, but like private. I don't know. I maybe that's a silly question.
I've guess been an advisor to a company called Burst IQ since 2015. Mm-hmm. And I first ran across Burst IQ during Denver Startup Week, and one of their executives was talking about what it was they were doing with health data, and it absolutely blew my mind. So I'd been in these meetup groups talking about crypto and the possibilities of what the technology would enable, and all of a sudden, in 2015, I was listening to a group talking about what they were actively doing with health data on chain. And it blew my mind, and I've been involved with them ever since. So I think the best use case I would point to is definitely what Burst IQ has done. Mm-hmm. And they're the way to think of them is more of the bridges and tunnels connecting these siloed data repositories between large provider groups. Now, you absolutely hit on a crucial point, which is why isn't this being driven internally by the healthcare providers? And I think there's a cynical answer to that, which is it's not nearly as valuable to them to make the patient the net beneficiary of their health information. It's incredibly valuable to be the fiduciary of that health data repository and just to sell that, to use that to synthesize new treatments and therapeutics and sell those on. So there's But in a lot of ways, we're seeing this transformation happen. Whether the big providers wanted to or not, there's still this phenomenon of code eating the world. And when there are better, cheaper, faster solutions, they win out. So in a properly functioning market, we see the better solutions coming online. And Burst is having steady growth year on year. And has really developed some of the most compelling tech in the space. And it leads to one other vastly important point, maybe the most powerful aspect of distributed ledger generally, which is identity and the ability to create a self-sovereign identity, one that is not specifically reliant upon a government agency to issue it. So instead of a driver's license, you would have this idea of an on-chain identity. So not a new concept, far from it. And there are lots of examples and initiatives pushing this. But Burst has actually gone very far in this regard because they have to. In order to make medical data shareable in this way, they've had to create this credentialing system to anchor an individual based not just on a government ID, but also on their medical data. And then we can start layering in all sorts of other things as well. So that's a massively exciting component of what the tech unlocks. And is probably, that's the trillion-dollar company. Whomever solves digital identity, the services that flow from that are unbelievable and also maybe terrifying to a lot of people. So we see digital identity in places like China, and that can be used as a tool of massive social control and coercion. We don't want that. What we want is to be the owners of our data and our digital lives. What we do not want is to be coerced by a faceless bureaucracy somewhere else that has its own motivations and agendas, et cetera. And so because of that pushback, that interplay between the two, I think that's dramatically slowed us down. So the promise of the tech is there. The implementation of the tech is not, and it's this creative destruction that we watch in the regulatory sphere. And that's, again, a big piece of why I got involved with the OECD and you know, along with others like Joe Lubin, worked on these blockchain policy principles, which are high level, but they're principles based. So there's some compelling things to draw out of those policy principles. They're recommendations, they're not law. So it's still up to the individual member states to actually adopt these things. But the clearest cut use cases, I think, are around things like healthcare. I think that the final thing I would say on the regulatory side of this global debate is that there's still time to make progress. This isn't settled. There are significant initiatives underway in the US, and I can be hopeful for favorable results. We've seen some court cases that have taken a much more clinical eye to both the government position and industry's position. And those are very promising signs, and we need to follow through on those. In the meantime, significant progress has been made in places like Bermuda and Mauritius, and in the EU specifically. So there's some real signs of hope. There are problematic elements if you're a crypto maxi. Maybe I'm probably going to anger many people by saying crypto maxi. But
that's okay.
Fair enough. It is what it is. There's always been this interplay between crypto assets, native digital assets, regulators, and banks. And the banking situation is one of the key pieces of the puzzle to be solved. And so it remains to be seen how an appropriate framework will come into being. I've had conversations with Caitlin Long, who's the CEO and founder of Custodia Bank in Wyoming, who's gone through a long and protracted battle to get access to full banking and launch her bank with full federal access, even though she's followed all of the rules there. So there's that interplay. And then we see phenomenon like what's going on in places like Bermuda, where you have a very cohesive regulatory community with a single set of rules. And they're in Bermuda in particular, with its large reinsurance business, it is not at all afraid of engaging with the top businesses on the planet. So they're very used to heavy duty compliance, and they see the opportunity in this. And so they're, in a way, we've seeded the field. As as an American, I can say that we've seen fits and starts for fully integrated crypto banking, and we've taken some steps away from that. Other places have taken steps directly toward it, and I think we'll be big net beneficiaries going forward.
I am going to put some information about Burst IQ in the show notes. I did have a look at some of the work that they're doing with LifeGraph, and I found it super interesting. So I think it's even just for people to have
precision medicine. Oh, this is my favorite.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I don't think we're going to be able to dive super deep further
that's
into that.
Whole, but that's a whole episode. That's a fantastic topic.
I also think it helps people understand, even if they're not necessarily interested in healthcare specifically, but I think it helps give an idea of how these technologies work together. I think it was in that reading where I had a little bit of an aha moment when they refer to permissionless access to data and using smart contracts. And I think for someone like myself, and I've been, paying attention to some of this technology for the last few years, but I'm still so much of a layperson when it comes to technology. I'm not a technologist. I have a real estate background. And, when I realized there was an opportunity for me to learn a little bit more about blockchain technology, it was because of that real estate kind of industry sector background. I thought, okay, smart contracts. And I'm thinking about smart contracts in a very literal way. And so this was my aha moment. The language of smart contracts to me, I'm like, okay, you can use these to replace other forms of more archaic traditional contract systems, legal documentation, et cetera. But I think that, and maybe you can help me unpack this just a little bit, but I think it's just these points of, I say permission because if someone does A, it might equal B, and then C happens. And so I think that if we can just talk a little bit about, in a non-technical way, what a smart contract really is and how, for Definitely. Example, you can then give access to your data, it might help frame a better understanding of this technology. Because I think even myself, until very recently, I wasn't thinking about it in the right way.
Definitely. And I remember thinking a lot about this in the early days as a lawyer, and coming to the realization that They are neither smart nor contracts. What they are is a piece of self-executing code. And that's very powerful. So, you know, the smart contract, the highest level way to think of a smart contract is when a particular action happens, in this case, think of it in terms of sending ETH into a smart contract, it triggers some other action. And those things are all automated. And because they're distributed, they're locked in. So they're no longer voluntary agreements. Once you've committed the terms to this, when the gas goes into the smart contract, an output happens. And nothing can stop that output from happening. We can replicate that, particularly using AI, millions of times a minute. And depending on which architecture we're talking about, those are real numbers. So on the Ethereum blockchain, not quite as fast. In something like Hedera and the hash graph, that fast. So we can have unbelievable numbers of these self-executing transactions happening. That becomes incredibly powerful when we're dealing with things like the sharing of medical data, the sharing of any biometric information. So to break that down, like, why is that important? It's the missing layer of AI in terms of being able to take real-world actions in an auditable, safe way. So crypto and DLT is the trust layer of our digital lives. AI, we're having an enormous time trusting it. There's this trust gap in AI. When we put the two together, that's where we're able to unlock this sense of digital abundance that has been foretold for the last several decades, but always seems just a little bit out of reach. As these things mesh, that's really sort of the technological singularity. People that are big AI fans won't like me calling anything a singularity because that has a very specific reference, but that's when we begin to see a lot of cost savings, and whether those are passed on to the consumers or not is an open question. This is a piece of regulation that we need to understand. At the moment, these phenomenon inure to the benefit of massive corporates, and they are integrating these things as quickly and aggressively as they can. Whether they pass those savings along, and if you're a for-profit company, you have a fiduciary duty to your shareholders, and as a director of that entity, you're looking to maximize those profits. So why would you pass on these savings that you're seeing? So that's where a policy framework becomes very important, to look at this from a human-centric standpoint. And how do we create the most human flourishing, the most human abundance, using these tech tools that are now at our disposal? And how do we also prevent some sort of dystopian nightmare that is also enabled by a lot of these tools, particularly AI? And I think blockchain is a central component of that. And that's a lot of why Orbu was created. And so There's a prediction market component to Orbu, which is the front end. But the back end of what we're really accomplishing with this is an AI ethical safety database. And that's its own whole podcast, which I love to break that down in granular detail as well.
Well, we will link to Orbu in the show notes. I think that knowing that people are looking to solve some of these inherent challenges that come with the technology is very promising. And I think when some of these tools are created and adopted, it might maybe could help deal with some of these other challenges that we have with regulators, for example. Like, if there are tools in place to help understand, how data is being created and distributed and how it's being used, I think that matters. So I think you guys are doing great work, and I would love to have that conversation where we can dive deeper into that. We have referenced in our conversation today a little bit about sustainability, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but since we're on the topic of sort of some of this technology for good, I think blockchain technology in way of cryptocurrencies and NFTs have had received like pretty bad narrative around their environmental impacts for a variety of, and some very valid reasons, although we've seen major evolution in some of these technologies over the last several years. Ethereum, as an example, reducing its carbon footprint by 99.9% when it moved from proof of work to proof of stake. I'm still getting the language right.
Nailed it.
And so that being said, we know there's other things happening related to sustainability and some of the good work that this technology can do. Can you give us just a general overview? And if our audience thinks it's interesting, we'll make sure to dive even deeper in another episode. Definitely. Yeah.
So I actually got into a bit of a heated debate at the OECD on this very topic, which is actually kind of rare in these large conveners. They're usually quite polite, but I was rather annoyed at an OECD conference last year when this point was brought up and the Bitcoin's carbon footprint was bandied about without any comparison to what the traditional financial system requires to function. So yes, Bitcoin, we can measure the value of Bitcoin by how much energy it creates to produce. That's a fact. And it definitely requires a lot of energy. I'm personally a part of initiatives that use renewables for mining. All of that squares nicely, and I'm at peace with it. And without getting hyper-political on whether you're on one side or the other of this issue, the fundamental point is that Bitcoin burns a lot of energy. It absolutely does. And that's actually one way to come up with a value of a Bitcoin, is how much energy it's taking to power this network and to secure it. Now, when we juxtapose that with the current financial system, with all of its legacy costs, physical buildings, massive infrastructure, employees, each of their carbon footprints, just to run that, it's minuscule in comparison. And the amount of value, it's actually hyper-efficient in comparison. And the amount of value that can be anchored onto the Bitcoin network is enormous. Some estimates say that using things like the Lightning Network, we could anchor all of the world's value just onto the Bitcoin blockchain. It's like we have the equivalent of a tricycle parked inside of this enormous Fort Knox-style vault. So in short, Bitcoin burns an enormous amount of energy. That is true. But when compared to the number of transactions and what it can facilitate, a very strong argument can be made that it's actually a safer alternative than legacy financial systems. And then, you know, we get into an entire philosophical debate on the merits of Bitcoin versus not. If you're not into Bitcoin, there are dozens of other really compelling solutions that are fully deployed now as well that have that are effectively carbon neutral. So when we talk about a firm like Hedera, their HBAR, it moves, it's a DLT, so it's not blockchain, it's DLT, but it moves faster than a blockchain transaction and effectively for free. So those types of systems become incredibly empowering and super important when we talk about things like global foreign exchange and how to smooth out the rough edges around Forex, around remittances globally for impoverished countries, on and on. So there are definitely eco-friendly solutions if that's the primary motivation. But I tend to fall on the side of Bitcoin as a social good, and legacy banking has all sorts of inherent costs that don't actually need to be there that are rubbed out when we're dealing with Bitcoin as a base case and then other solutions that can be compelling for different use cases. In terms of other compelling environmental initiatives, one of the most troubling things that we watch right now is this phenomenon of greenwashing, where something appears to be an ESG viable candidate and really isn't. And blockchain is a perfect solution to those kinds of conversations. So there are a few initiatives out there that look to take carbon assets, carbon credits, carbon offsets, et cetera, and register them on chain so that both the provenance of the offset itself and the trading of that offset or credit is dramatically enhanced. So similar to what we saw with the NFT boom, this is a good
The NFT thing was fascinating for a lot of reasons, but as a use case for what's possible on chain, it was really a compelling thing. Now the prices and supply demand got very strange and exciting, but with really boring use cases like supply chains or the trading of carbon credits, they're very ironclad use cases that make a ton of sense, that are perfect uses for the tech.
Yeah, I think that's a topic I'd like to dive a bit deeper into and better understand and help people understand, how those mechanisms work, and recognize that they're likely going to be, incorporated into our future and our businesses. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can ask you just a random question about, do you see, and I realize you've said you're not a predictor. Can you imagine in 10 years, an industry or sector where like blockchain type technology and AI that will not be touched by these technologies in a significant way?
I can't. I mean, it impacts every part of the human experience. And the modern human experience mm-hmm. will be impacted in some way by these technologies. AI is the scarier one in a lot of ways, and that's why there's this pressing need to understand the overlap between AI and DLT and how you can use them to complement one another to make them both better. So mm-hmm. in healthcare, we see very profound examples of that already. We'll see it in financial services. We'll see it in voting. And we're really at the precipice at the moment of really understanding what the regulatory response should be versus what it is, and how to facilitate the good aspects and try to mitigate against the bad ones. And it's far from over is the short answer. Things like the blockchain policy recommendation and the AI policy principles, when you read them together, that is a framework for Web3, and that's a good place. And so a lot of the work that Cyrus and I are doing right now is synthesizing those two and then having conversations with thought leaders that have crossed over between the two. So guys like Sandy Pentland is a really interesting one. He's an MIT professor, and he sat on both the blockchain policy recommendation group as well as the AI policy principle group. So there's a lot of work that's being done there, but it's still amorphous. It's not accessible enough, and it's not immediate enough to the common voter to understand what the impact of these policies really is. And it's to me, it's the difference between having sovereignty over things like your medical data and being able to control that and even benefit from it, monetize it in a safe way, versus turning that over to the major providers and letting them continue to benefit from your data. So mm-hmm. I think that's the best real world use case that's the most immediate, particularly with our aging population, revolves around this intersection of the tokenization and shareability of our health data, and then the precision medicine aspects that come into that using sophisticated AI to diagnose things well before they manifest and really expand human flourishing, drive down costs, make life better. And that's what this should be focused on, not the nefarious elements that maybe are trying to dodge KYC checks. So there's mm-hmm. And we talked about this briefly, but it really is kind of the most powerful element that has yet to be fully deployed and developed, and that's digital identity. So self-sovereign identity on chain, if somebody can figure out how to do that at scale and get the adoption, and I work at that from the policy side, innovators work at that from the tech side, there have been many attempts, but that's the core of how we would have the ability to freely transact with our data without these elements of social control that are so troubling for good reason, right? There's reason to be scared for sure. There's also plenty of reason to be optimistic. I think it's the purpose of a podcast like yours that really get to engage and have these conversations in an informal way where we get to just freely think about the implications of these things, and then maybe spur some further reading and further thought. And you know, hopefully this is the first of a few sessions with you, because I think you're really asking the right question.
Well, I really appreciate your time today, Benjamin. This has been very insightful, learning a lot. And as I said, I'm having some aha moments as I'm going through some of the resources and referenced work that you're affiliated with. So I want to thank you. I will also put links in the show notes to Benjamin and his LinkedIn profile, his I still say Twitter, because I feel like when you say X, people aren't quite relating. We'll make sure to also link to some of your projects like Orbu.ai, so people can learn more. Well, I really appreciate it, Benjamin. This has been great. I do hope we have further conversations. Everyone listening, thank you so much for tuning in. We will see you again next week. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of From the Blockchain. I really hope you enjoyed the show. If you have any ideas about future episodes, including themes or potential guests, please check for a link in the show notes. Happy to hear from you. Also, if you're interested in being a potential sponsor for From the Blockchain, I'd love to hear from you as well. Check for a special link just for you in the show notes. All right, everybody, again, thanks for being here. Love the show. Love being with you. Please remember to subscribe, review, and share with your friends. Until next week, have a great one.